Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies.
Welcome to the latest Oxford Institute for Energy Studies podcast. My name is David Ledesma, and I'm Distinguished Research Fellow at the OIES. It's a great pleasure to be joined today by my good friend Martin Lambert, who's head of the Hydrogen Research Programme at the OIES. And we're here today to discuss the key messages that came from the paper Clean Hydrogen Roadmap: Is Greater Realism Leading to a More Credible Path Forward? And this was published by the Institute in September 2023. Martin, welcome back to the OIS podcast series.
David, thanks very much. It's great to be back.
Now, just to timestamp this podcast before we start, Martin, we're recording it on the afternoon of the 11th of October 2023. Now, Martin, why don't we start perhaps with a kind of a simple question, you know? Can you explain to our listeners what was the motivation for publishing your paper at this particular time?
Well, we launched the hydrogen programme back in April 2022 with the overarching theme of building business cases for a hydrogen economy. And since then, working with the hydrogen team, we've been researching many detailed aspects of that. And we produced several individual papers on particular topics. And all of those, of course, available on the OIS website. And the point of this paper then was really to step back from all the details and explore some of the overarching key themes which we thought it was important to highlight. That's partly a look back at what we've learned, but also looking forward. It's setting a framework for further research that we can do under the programme.
So do you want to perhaps say a bit more about kind of the rationale for the hydrogen programme and, you know, what is the overarching theme of that programme?
Yeah, well, as I said, the overarching key theme is building business cases for a hydrogen economy. And the reason we set that as the overall theme was because we were observing lots of bold claims and ambition and targets, but most of those were pretty unrealistic. And the reality is everything that's been happening so far has been very small. And one little anecdote, I mean, people often talk about who's winning in the hydrogen race. And I'd say, well, actually, it's really a marathon, not a sprint. And you think a marathon's like 42 kilometres long, I'd say we're not even past the first 100 metres, so there's a very long way to go. If I put that into more energy terms, then in Europe, RePowerEU set a target of 10 million tonnes by 2030. And we wrote a paper about a year ago on that, pointing out that would require 120 gigawatts of renewable power and electrolysers, and currently the biggest electrolyzer under construction, actually in Europe or anywhere in the world, is around 200 megawatts. So to get from 200 megawatts to 120 gigawatts is a pretty tall order. So there's a long way to go in that hydrogen race. And the business case plan is really to understand what it will take to let big investments happen at scale to get hydrogen off the ground.
So, Martin, the paper discusses the key themes from the hydrogen research programme since its inception. So can you say, you know, what are these themes? And also, you know, what do you expect to get out of them? And perhaps share more detail.
Well, so the paper highlighted six key themes overall. So I'll run through them all fairly quickly and then we can get into more detail afterwards. So the first one was about hydrogen being in competition with other decarbonisation alternatives. What that means is particularly things like electricity, maybe carbon capture and storage, or other decarbonisation options. But there's no sort of silver bullet where hydrogen plays a role. That's number one. Number two is saying that to develop that business case we talked about, it relies on government policy, and that government policy is around decarbonisation. And there could be some combination of compulsion, call them sticks, or incentives, call them carrots. So number two, government policy. Number three, which is kind of related, is about understanding the emissions that are related to particular investments. And measuring emissions is really very, very difficult. But if you can't measure something, it's pretty hard to manage it. That's why that's a pretty important theme. And then the last three, so 4, 5, and 6, are kind of related. Number 4, we say that we need to look at the full value chain of hydrogen investments, meaning that you can't just look at the production part or the consumption part. You need to look at how hydrogen will flow from production to consumption with storage and transport in the middle. And so for that reason, 5 and 6 are then transport, where and the theme there is that transport is expensive, and so we think it should be minimized. And we'll say more later, that doesn't mean it shouldn't be transported at all, but really should be minimized. And finally, storage is a pretty important part of that value chain, and we think has been rather underexplored so far. So those are the 6. So quite a long list, really.
Yeah, and certainly a lot to talk about during this podcast. So, Martin, why don't we go back to the beginning and talk about kind of the first point you raised, which is the need for hydrogen to be competitive with other alternatives. Now, that does seem a bit obvious to me, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, it does sound quite obvious, doesn't it? I mean, most of the world runs on competition, but it's something which seems to be fairly easily forgotten about. In the title of the paper, I talk about greater realism, and that's good. Because I think if you go back a few years, even though the competitive thing was obvious, people were kind of ignoring it. And when I wrote my first paper on hydrogen back in 2020, there was a feeling that hydrogen was some kind of silver bullet and be used absolutely everywhere. I think now, with that reality, there are people realizing it will have a role somewhere, but not in others. So a couple of examples. Space heating is one where in the past there was a feeling, particularly in the UK probably, that hydrogen would just replace natural gas in the old natural gas system. So we convert gas pipes to carry hydrogen, we convert houses with gas boilers to have a hydrogen boiler. But now I think people are realizing from an efficiency point of view, if you start from renewable power, it's much more efficient to use a heat pump rather than making hydrogen and then burning hydrogen in a boiler. Similar sort of story around road transport, that if you you could have a fuel cell vehicle running on hydrogen, but the competition there has pretty clearly shown that battery electric vehicles are winning the race. So I think hydrogen, some niche in road transport perhaps, but most road transport will be battery electric. That may all sound a bit negative, but I think on the other hand, from a competitive point of view, there are also areas where hydrogen is going to be really important. It will vary a bit from country to country and region to region, but we're pretty sure that current industrial uses, so refining, petrochemicals, especially making ammonia, for there's no alternative because hydrogen's a feedstock and you need to use hydrogen. So that's going to carry on happening. I guess on refining, you might say, well, in a move to net zero, we'll stop refining oil. And that's probably generally true, but will be replaced probably with some e-fuels or synthetic fuels, particularly for aviation or marine. So there'll still be some kind of role for hydrogen in that production of e-fuels. Also on ammonia, well, it's currently used mainly for fertilizer. In the future, we think it'll also be used as some kind of fuel in its own right or for carrying hydrogen. The big new one, I think, is steelmaking. So currently we use coal in steelmaking. That needs to go, and hydrogen seems to have really no competitors currently as a way to reduce iron. So I think lots of ways where hydrogen will have a role, but that competitive lens is pretty important and will doubtless evolve over time as well. But we shouldn't forget about the need for competition.
Absolutely. I think there's a huge amount of positivity as well, as you say. Now, your second theme, which you summarised earlier on, is around the whole business case relying on government policy. So perhaps, you know, can you explain that a little bit more for our listeners?
I guess to some extent it's true not just for hydrogen, but for decarbonisation in general. And that's driven also a bit by the, I suppose, the competition thing, the earlier point, because any commercial decision maker, given a free hand, would typically go for the lowest cost or highest value alternative. And in the absence of government policy, that will likely be continued use of fossil fuels, and in the case of hydrogen, continued use of so-called grey hydrogen from unabated natural gas. In fact, the data backs up that statement. Just in the last week or so, the IEA has published its latest global hydrogen review, and that notes in 2022, global hydrogen use grew by about 1 million tonnes a year, but nearly all of that increase was from unabated fossil fuels. So at this stage, the increase in production of low-carbon hydrogen isn't even keeping up with the growth in total hydrogen demand. And what we need to get to, of course, is a situation where low-carbon hydrogen is growing fast and displacing fossil fuel-derived hydrogen. So again, quite a long way to go on that. And government policy needs to drive that. And you can see, so where projects have taken FID so far, so final investment decision, it's been supported by some kind of direct government support. And a good example of that, I think, is in Saudi Arabia, the NEOM project, where, as I have more detail in the paper, the government provided about $3 billion and private lenders provided about $6 billion. So government funding can then enable private funding, which is good. Also in the paper, I go into more detail about other types of government support which could come in the future, and I divide them into sticks and carrots. So sticks being ways the government forces things to happen, and carrots being incentives. And I won't cover all of them now on this podcast, but say it's all there in the paper. But if I give a couple of incentive examples, the Saudi Arabia example is one about direct government support. And another one still being developed is in the UK, the government's developing a hydrogen business model with a contract for difference, where the government will support the investor by paying a strike price for the hydrogen. And then on the compulsion or sticks side, a positive development is the EU in their latest renewable energy directive have recently approved a policy that by 2030, 42% of hydrogen used in industry should be low carbon. That will still rely on member states to work out the details, but that, of course, will create a real market for clean hydrogen, because everyone will be kind of forcing people to move from high carbon hydrogen to lower carbon hydrogen. You could say there's a risk of driving hydrogen production out of Europe, but I guess that's a policy, and the European Union are trying to manage that through the carbon border adjustment mechanism as well. So a very complex topic, but government policy is key to making hydrogen happen.
Yeah, well, moving from one complex subject to perhaps the kind of fiendishly difficult one, and that is your third theme, which is the need to understand the emissions associated with potential hydrogen investments. So perhaps you can kind of share with us some of the challenges there, and maybe hopefully some of the solutions.
As I said, a driver of clean hydrogen clearly is the desire to decarbonize and so reduce emissions. And one of our themes we've talked about in various workshops in the program is you can only manage what you measure. But the snag of measuring emissions is, as you've said, is very, very complicated, because it's not just emissions from one process, but it's along a complex value chain. For example, if you look at an electrolyzer making hydrogen from electricity, you might think, oh, that's good, it's all very clean, there's no emissions from that process, you split water into hydrogen and oxygen. But the reality is that if that electricity is coming from a grid where there's a large amount of fossil fuels on the grid, then it's not so clean after all. And even if you build a wind farm next to your electrolyzer, you could still argue to some extent that the renewable power could have been used to stop burning coal or gas elsewhere on the grid, and so it's still not so green as all that. And that leads to big debates among policymakers. So in Europe, I think we've now bottomed out the definition around additionality. So that's quite a big step forward for encouraging investors. Surprisingly, perhaps, in the US, the debate is still running. So a year ago, the Inflation Reduction Act came out in the US, and everyone thought, wow, with $3 a kilogram tax credit, then all investment will be rushing to the US. The reality is that 14 months on, that rush hasn't yet happened because no one's yet defined in the US how they can qualify to get that largest amount of tax credit. And if you invested thinking you get $3 a kilo, you're not getting $1 a kilo or less, then that's not a very good investment incentive at all. Finally, I should mention certification, which is the subject of a current research paper being worked on by the team. Currently, there's lots of different ways of certifying emissions around the world, and that will need to get unified so there's more consistency, particularly if we want to move from hydrogen being local to hydrogen being more of a traded quantity. So lots to talk about on emissions, and so I'm sure the research programme will be doing a lot more on that in the coming years.
Now, as you said, Martin, your last three themes are all kind of related. You know, so you talk about supply chains, transport and storage and as kind of key and important considerations. So can you perhaps, again, share with our listeners some of these issues in more detail?
I mean, again, in some ways, the fact that supply chains are important also should be kind of obvious. And with your and my experience in the LNG business, then that has always been the case. When you build an LNG chain, you have to put the production, the shipping and the receiving terminal and power plant all together. And it's quite similar for hydrogen. We've talked in the paper about what we've called four archetype supply chains because it varies from case to case. So the easy one, which very interestingly has been where those investments that have happened already have almost been in our kind of simple archetype of starting with an existing hydrogen consumer, like a refinery or an ammonia plant, and just substituting some of the high carbon hydrogen with some low carbon hydrogen. And so that's our first simple archetype. And then if you build on those, again, more details in the paper, then you get to linkages between production and consumption, then you add in a network in the middle, and then a bit of storage, and that adds more complexity, and putting the supply chain together probably gets harder as you progress through the archetypes. To the transport and storage bit, so I'm going to that if you like, I say in the paper that the transport of hydrogen should be minimised, and that doesn't mean no transport at all, because in some cases there may be no alternative. For example, in Japan, they are not going to have enough renewable power to run the economy, so importing something like ammonia is seen to be a key part of the solution. But wherever you can, because hydrogen is much more difficult than oil and more difficult than gas to transport, you want to minimize its transport. And so that's why shipping a derivative like ammonia or a liquid like toluene or methyl cyclohexane or even eLNG, those could all be ways of transporting hydrogen, but all way more expensive than transporting oil. And so we think as far as possible, hydrogen will be local, but there will be cases where it still has to be transported. And then finally on storage then, which is the last part of the supply chain, and as I said at the start, we think it really hasn't had enough attention because it's really quite difficult to store hydrogen in large quantities. If you think about one of the likely applications is in power generation, and in power generation, going to have to store hydrogen for the long term, then use it when there isn't enough wind or solar to meet the demand. And storing it requires salt caverns, and salt caverns are quite limited. So again, more detail in the paper, but storage is a real challenge and needs some real focus, I think, in the coming years to scale up enough storage.
So, Martin, as we come to the kind of end of this podcast, you know, you've spoken a lot about the challenges of making clean hydrogen happen. And I'm just wondering, you know, does that mean that we should kind of forget hydrogen and think about something else? I hope that's not the case, but it does kind of make me kind of think that way. And I'm sure some of our listeners are also thinking on that path as well.
I sometimes feel that I'm being a bit negative about the whole thing, but I think that's really not the case. That'd be the wrong impression to take away. I think what I'm trying to do is be realistic about the challenges. And as I said at the start, for the right applications, clean hydrogen is going to be an essential part of the energy transition. In fact, so essential, it's really important we get on the journey and start scaling it up really quickly. Because for refining, e-fuels, petrochemicals, there is really no realistic alternative. And so we do need to get that scale-up journey really happening. But I think the greater realism, which I've talked about a few times, is really quite important. Because if we just base our future projections on sort of hope and aspiration, then we're likely to come unstuck. But if we start from realizing what the challenges are, then we're pretty good normally at figuring out ways to overcome the challenges. So I'm fairly hopeful that with this increasing realism and with some final investment decisions now starting to happen, we are starting on that scale-up journey. And then I'm also hopeful that with the Institute, with the research that we do, and with the framework set out by this paper, we can really help that process of figuring out some of the best commercial structures and the best policy instruments to overcome the challenge. So we're really looking forward to carrying on working with our sponsors and being involved in the industry as we take this work further forward.
Well, Martin, you know, as you said earlier on, the hydrogen program has kind of only been operating since April 2022. And in what? Well, that's not a year and a half. There's a huge amount of research being done. And I know over the next year and a half, there'll be considerably more done as well. So again, I urge our listeners to look at our website for that output. But, you know, thank you very much for your time today. As always, I really enjoy our conversations. And this one builds on the messages from your paper, Clean Hydrogen Roadmap, Is Greater Realism Leading to More Credible Paths Forward? That was published, as I said earlier on, by the Institute in September 2023. So I hope you've all enjoyed listening to this podcast. Thank you and goodbye, everyone.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. You can find other podcasts, as well as our written research, on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org. If you would like more details about our energy transition, gas, oil, electricity, or China research programs, then please contact us at information@oxfordenergy.org.